First, an acknowledgement of a milestone. This episode marks our return to regularly producing totally new Death, Sex, and Money episodes from our new home at Slate. We celebrated our revival with a live show that we shared with you early last month, and then we've been revisiting some of our favorite episodes to remind you why we love making this show. And now we are back, baby. Now, one thing I want to note during this transition, I've been asked by a lot of you how the show is going to change at our new home at Slate. The biggest change you'll notice, we're now dropping episodes on Tuesdays, no longer on Wednesdays. But otherwise, as we relaunch at Slate, we are going to keep doing what we do, which is to say, bring you interviews from all sorts of people, famous and not famous, about the parts of life that can make us feel bewildered, alone, and just generally not talked about openly enough. And our show, we try to be precise about our differences without dismissing them. There are some things, though, that we all share. Experts say we're born with a few primary emotions: joy, fear, sadness, disgust, and anger. That's it. Secondary emotions like guilt, shame, pride, and empathy, those come from interacting with others, what we're taught, and how sensitive we are to external feedback. But this new episode today, it got me thinking about how off my assumptions can be about people's emotional responses. Patrick Gagné was diagnosed as a sociopath in her early 20s. She describes the experience as having an emotional learning disability. And through our conversation, I thought about my relationship to shame, about how a life without shame could feel beautifully liberating, but also how shame and guilt can be useful to remind us that it's not all about us as individuals and that we owe some consideration to our effects on others. That's what Patrick and I dig into in this episode. I hope you enjoy it as much as I do.
The only thing I could count on the truth to do was to get me into further trouble, admitting to these things that I didn't feel empathy, that I didn't feel guilt, that I didn't care about the things that I was quote unquote supposed to care about. That was a fast track to danger.
This is Death, Sex, and Money, the show from Slate about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. Patrick Gagné is 48. She has two kids and is married to someone she met when she was 14. She's a PhD in clinical psychology, and this month is achieving a new professional milestone, publishing her first book, a memoir about her life. And like most milestones, she told me that people around her have expected her to feel a certain way about it.
You know, you go around and are you so excited? Are you so excited? And there's that expectation of excitement. But I don't have that. I don't have that emotional reaction that people are seeking. And I have to remind myself, you don't have to have that emotional reaction. And you can let them know, I don't really experience it that way.
Oh, you're making me realize like small talk must be this like minefield for you, because there's all these casual ways people try to connect by like sort of like, you must feel really excited. You must feel really, oh gosh, are you really tired or worn out? Like, no, not necessarily.
Yeah.
You know? Huh.
Yeah.
And you, I just want to make clear, you are a PhD in clinical psychology.
Correct.
You also self-identify as a sociopath.
Well, I was diagnosed as a sociopath. I would not be diagnosed as a sociopath today. Oh. I would be diagnosed, and indeed I have been, assessed as secondary psychopathic.
What it technically means to be a sociopath or a psychopath has changed over the last few decades as the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM, the big reference book psychologists use to diagnose mental disorders, is often updating. Currently, sociopathy and psychopathy are both thought of as forms of antisocial personality disorders, conditions where people have trouble accessing those secondary social emotions, Patrick was born in Los Angeles in 1976. Her parents split up when she was 11, and then she moved with her mother and sister to Florida. Patrick said her mother tried to teach her how to be more sensitive to others as she was growing up, but it never came naturally.
When my mother would attempt to teach me things in much the same way she taught my sister, like, listen, we don't take the bubble gum from the store because that's bad and we don't want to be bad, right? My sister would internalize those things like a neurotypical person would. Oh, yes, I don't want to be bad. I want to be good. I won't do that anymore. Whereas my response was more of, I don't care.
I'm very interested to hear what it was like to come of age as a girl in the 80s without the ability to feel shame. And the other thing I want to say before we sort of really dive in is, like, I was curious, Patrick, if I was going to be able to hear something different in your voice, like in the way that you speak and relate, because I feel like so much about how we talk and use our voice is relational. Have you had to learn how to speak in the way that you're speaking? Because I'm not picking up a distinction.
No, I don't think so. And I also think that speaks to that hallmark sociopathic trait, which is the charm, manipulation and charm. But again, you know, as is the case with so many sociopathic traits, you know, when you say lack of remorse or manipulation and charm, my guess is, as someone who is neurotypical, your reaction is like, ugh. But what I'm trying to get people to understand is the motivation behind those for so many people on the sociopathic spectrum is not to harm, if it's to protect. So I learned very quickly that acting like everybody else and smiling and doing the things that are pleasing is the fastest way to go unnoticed. Mm-hmm.
So you describe the way that the DSM has categorized sociopaths has evolved over time. And our show is also DSM, Death, Sex, and Money. So I want to go through DSM with you and understand how your relationship to death, sex, and money has evolved over time. And I want to start with death. You talk about your first encounter with death being a real watershed moment and not only realizing you were different, but also your family recognizing in a deep way that you were different. What happened?
So my pet ferret, our pet ferret, passed away.
A ferret. What was the ferret's name?
Her name was Baby. And when she passed away, it was fairly unexpected. And I remember my sister having a very huge reaction to this loss, an appropriate huge reaction. Mm. And I didn't. And although I understood cognitively why my sister was having such a large emotional reaction, I couldn't make myself feel those feelings. Mm. And I remember feeling for the first time, oh, this is probably what people talk about when they describe jealousy, because I wish that I could be experiencing the same emotions as my sister, if for no other reason than because I knew that my mother was going to misinterpret my lack of emotion as though I didn't care. And it's not that I didn't care. I just wasn't emoting.
Is sadness not an emotion that you think of as inherent? Like when there is loss?
Yes.
Why does loss not register if sadness isn't hard?
I think that I probably was sad, but the way that I experienced that sadness was not the way my sister was experiencing it. I was sad that my buddy was gone. I was going to miss my buddy, but I also felt there was a logic. There was almost a beauty in it. There was this being that was inhabiting this body. Now it's just gone. And I was more curious. Uh-huh. Where did it go? And I remember going and sitting with her and looking and really taking a good long look at her body and feeling a certain degree of validation in my feelings of, yeah, she's not here. And I remember a similar experience with my great grandmother when she passed. I wanted to spend a lot of time with her body because I was so fascinated with the fact that she was gone and yet the body remained. I found that very curious. I also understood that that was not a request that was met with a lot of compassion or understanding.
As a child, not being scared or outwardly emotional bothered Patrick's mother, who wanted more from her daughter. Patrick wanted to make her mother happy. And all those expectations about what she was supposed to feel started to make Patrick anxious, a state she began to refer to as stuck stress.
The best way that I can describe it is what I understand their neurotypical experience of claustrophobia to be like. Entrapment, needing to not get out, but this feeling of pressure where there's an expectation that I need to feel or act a certain way.
As we talk about sort of like death, I also want to ask about violence. Mm-hmm. Will you tell me about the one act of violence that provided you with a sense of relief when you were a kid?
Yeah, a very early act of violence for me, probably the biggest one, certainly in my childhood, is I stabbed another child in the head with a pencil. And I remember as soon as I did it, it was as if all of the air had been let out of the stuck stress balloon. And it was this very surreal moment where I was standing there watching all of the other kids have very quote unquote appropriate reactions to what had happened. And I didn't have any of it. And I remember just walking away from the child and all of the other children that were gathered around and just walking home feeling the most intense peace. And when I went home, my parents were understandably upset. They demanded that I write an apology letter, which I was happy to write because I wasn't sorry that I did it, but I was sorry that I used an act of violence to achieve this peace that some part of me was struggling to find.
And when you say, I wasn't sorry that I did it, is it that like when you saw that this not only probably hurt her, it also probably really frightened her. Like, was it, when you observed that, was it sort of a flatness that you received that information with? Like what?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And just kind of help me understand that. Like what's not registering?
It's registering cognitively, but not emotionally.
Uh-huh.
So I understand this girl is in pain. This girl is in emotional distress. I am the cause of it, but I can't connect to it emotionally.
How badly was the child injured?
Not very badly. I know that sounds crazy considering I stabbed her in the head with a pencil. It was a lot of blood because it was a head injury, but she didn't have to go to the hospital. She didn't have to have stitches. And I am grateful for that. And I was grateful for that at the time because I didn't want to hurt this child. I didn't experience any pleasure from her pain. It was putting that pencil in her head to me was like popping a balloon with a pencil. That's what it felt like to me.
Did law enforcement get involved?
No. And, you know, I can speak to my experience as an affluent white woman, former child. Bottom line, I would not have gotten away with things like that or any of the subsequent things that I did if my race, gender, or socioeconomic background had been different. And if I had gotten into trouble, chances are it would have been resolved. That is not lost on me at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, often the only time you hear about who a sociopath is, it's somebody who's already incarcerated.
Well, and that's because statistics say that the prevalence of sociopathy is just under 5%. Now, when you consider that most of the diagnostic interviews are conducted in prisons, there's no way that that number isn't higher.
And 5% is not a small number, right?
No. So, yeah, that's what I'm saying. So let's just stick with 5%, okay? Yeah. That's roughly the same number as those who suffer from depression and bipolar disorders. And yet there are no books on sociopathy, not helpful ones anyway, no self-help manuals, no support groups, no treatment options, no research breaking down how does it affect African Americans? How does it affect men versus women? There's none of that.
Patrick first heard about sociopathy in college during a psychology course. She recognized herself and eventually got diagnosed in her early 20s and started therapy. But before she got professional help, Patrick developed a whole set of rules for herself to try to manage her compulsions, including violent ones, that came with feeling stuck stress. She realized that if she did small bad acts more often, she could avoid doing one big violent one later.
I started going out and following my neighbors and stealing a barrette or slamming a door or stealing backpacks. Those were smaller acts of deviance designed to prevent a giant earthquake.
And if you could describe what you think was the most helpful therapeutic treatment for you for coping, and I recognize there's been all sorts of interventions over the years, but for you, what in the end do you think helped you learn how to manage that stress that can build up so much inside of you?
First and foremost, it was normalization. Being told there's nothing wrong having limited access to feeling. It was like, okay, like this is what I kind of thought, but everything around me was indicating that wasn't the case. And okay, what a relief. Now let's get into the behavior. And cognitive behavioral interventions were really, really effective for me in that. The cognitive journaling and the reframing, catching myself, if I don't do a small bad thing, then the big bad thing is going, I'm not gonna have any control over it. The reframe being, no, actually, if you don't do something small, the bad thing, the bigger bad thing won't follow because you are going to take steps to get to the bottom of the anxiety or the apathy or whatever it is that's driving those compulsions.
It's not this inevitable build.
Correct. This is a belief system. This is an irrational belief system that I designed unconsciously as a child. And I never questioned it. And it wasn't until I was older that I was like, wait, this is the same stuff I've been doing since kindergarten. Maybe we should do something that's more evolved, more rooted in science or research. And that really helped.
Coming up, what money and sex are like for a sociopath.
It's funny, as I got older and I understood about women faking orgasms, I remember thinking, I've never faked an orgasm, but I faked the feeling orgasm countless times.
We are still in our first few months working at Slate here at Death, Sex, and Money, meeting new colleagues and trying to make professional connections and also friends. And I asked you in my newsletter to send us your work friend stories. Some of you told us about the moment you knew a colleague was going to be more than just a coworker.
When I met my friend John, we went to have lunch in the cafeteria, and he pulled out his two front teeth and said, I lost these in a pogo stick accident. And I was like, yeah, we're going to be friends.
Here's this like super happy guy with bright blue pants, had a bright blue guitar. And his spirit was just so free and open.
But the moment in my head that I remember when I knew we were probably going to become friends was when she came to lunch one day and asked if anybody would like to join her in being part of a Glee flash mob based on the TV show. And my immediate response was yes.
And you told us that some of those relationships have lasted through work changes and life stages.
We came back to work around the same time, me from maternity leave and her from bereavement. We were both in different kinds of shock, just trying to make our way through the world in very different types of transformative years. We got into this rhythm where she would come over after work and we ate nachos and sushi together. We drank a lot of wine and we all cried a lot.
We loved hearing your work friend stories. I'll share more in my newsletter. If you aren't getting it yet, sign up at annasale.substack.com. There's a link in our show notes. And another thing that's so great about work friends is you share a world and characters in that world and a language that people outside of your workplace don't speak. But I also have to say that some of my favorite things about talking about work with people I don't work alongside is hearing about their workplace drama. Like our producer, Zoe, she has this friend who she doesn't really know what the friend does at work, but she does know that she has two coworkers who are secretly dating. And I, like, don't know the first thing about designing a scientific experiment that can work out in the field, but I know all of these academics by name from hearing about them from Arthur, the ones that are really kind and supportive to grad students and the ones that are really petty and turfy. That's what I know about academic science. So we also want to hear about some of this from you, the stories about work that you hear from your non-work friends. Some of it sucks. Some of it is also funny. Some of it's absurd. And it's important sharing these stories. Venting about work can help us take some of our power back that we give away, toiling hour after hour. So we want to hear from you about your work gossip, what you hear and spill to your friends and family about work. Record a voice memo and send it to us at deathsexmoney@slate.com. This is Death, Sex, and Money from Slate. I'm Anna Sale. Patrick Gagné grew up with money. Her mom was in real estate, and her dad worked in music management with popular rock bands in Southern California. So money was always available. It was not a source of stress. But that didn't stop Patrick from sometimes seeing what she could get away with. Like when she took a job working for her father after college.
There was a time when I was working in the music business where I noticed that you could double bill. And often the person that you were double billing might not recognize it. And what I did was I opened a bank account. And I just started putting the double bill money in this bank account.
What happened to that account?
Okay, so I don't want to out the other person involved, but I'll just say this. Someone did catch on and said, how about you just give me that money? And I said, here you go. And I gave it to the other person. I just said, yeah, if you want it, take it.
So you figured out how to steal money and then didn't yourself do anything with it?
Like, no.
Do you have...
And that was always the case. Go ahead.
Well, like, so does money not excite you to spending money on yourself, kind of being Mm-mm. impulsive with money? Does it give you
no.
these sort of... No, it doesn't. Give you a thrill.
Mm-mm.
Have you ever cheated on your taxes?
I don't think so. Only because I have made a conscious effort when I was young. I remember the stock market, like someone kind of showed me the stock market. And I remember in my 20s thinking, I need to have nothing to do with this.
This could be a world of trouble.
Yes. Like I need to not know another thing about this at all. Like nothing. And taxes sort of fall into that. I have always... been fortunate enough to have accountants help me so that I don't
start looking at that.
Uh-huh. So you have created safeguards for yourself by having the right kind of help.
Yeah. And what, what a privilege take that is, you know, I mean, how nice for her.
Well, I don't know. A lot of people need help with their taxes because they're hard. And I need help with my taxes because I'm afraid I'm going to get in trouble with the government and they'll throw me in jail. You need help with your taxes so you don't, like, feel the appeal of how much could I get away with here.
Yes, correct. Yeah. Correct. But again, to your point, I have help. And that's just not the case for lots of people with my personality type. In my early 20s, if I didn't have access to accountants and lawyers and things like that, I probably would have done my taxes and I probably would have cheated on them and I probably would have gotten caught.
So I want to move to sex. You use the term moral flexibility at one point in the book, that because of this constellation of ways that you do and don't respond to different emotions, what's right or wrong is different. Do you think of moral, like, did moral flexibility come up in your sort of coming of age sex life? Like, were you open to things that other people, other women at the time or other, you know, I don't know, like, do you feel like that? Were you sort of, did you have a kind of, I don't know, looseness that you didn't notice around you?
Yes. And I think this is particularly because I was raised in the Baptist church. I was raised around friends who were raised in the Catholic church. And I remember hearing about them speak of things that to them were very taboo. And I remember thinking, really? Like, what's wrong with that? You know, who cares? And it was God. It was always God cares. And it's, but to sort of tease that out, okay, but how do you feel about it?
And I said looseness in that question above, and I meant emotional looseness, to be clear.
Are you calling me a whore?
I mean, do you think, like, were you open to just, I don't know, were you, did you have more partners? Were you more open? Was it fun to explore and experiment in a way that, you know, other people avoided because of fear of judgment?
I think if I had it to do over again, I would have. I didn't have as many partners as, quite frankly, I wish I had had. My first sexual experience was traumatic for me, but not for any of the reasons a neurotypical person would suspect. On paper, the experience was perfect. This person cared a great deal about me. The physical element was great, but like so many things with me, the emotional element wasn't. In fact, there was no emotional element for me at all. And like with many other occasions, I think a part of me had been holding out hope that sex for me would be an emotional experience. So when it wasn't, I was very disappointed. And, you know, and I just assumed I am broken in that way.
As you came to know this about yourself, was there ever a time where sort of where you were able to tap into pleasure?
Pleasure, yes. Emotion, no. So the physical element of it has always been enjoyable. I can access that easily.
And is, do you think you're able to access the pleasure part more readily because you're not trailed behind with a truckload of shame and expectations about what a good girl is supposed to want and not want?
I don't know. I'm sure. Again, I can only speak to what I've heard of that from, you know, from people about having those truckloads attached, and it sounds awful.
It's not great.
So I mean, and look, I mean, that's a great question. Like, yeah, I wonder if my ability to access physical pleasure works so well and has always worked so well because I don't have any of those hurdles to overcome, it certainly makes logical sense.
Patrick met David, her future husband, when she was 14 years old at summer camp. Unlike so much of Patrick's coming of age, falling for him as a camper, it wasn't hard or that different from what she saw other kids going through.
Well, I think it felt like it feels for other girls my age, which was part of what I loved so much about it. It was a very normal experience. And I think the reason it was normal is because I developed this relationship with David for the same reason that other girls do. Hey, this guy sees me and he likes what he sees.
And what you had to offer, which I just loved as a summer camper, was you were obsessed with maps and trying to find underground tunnels at the summer camp. And like Harriet the Spy, trying to find like the, I mean, you found
this. That's right, Harriet the Spy. I can't believe you said that. I lived for those books. Harriet the Spy was my hero. Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
I mean, that's what I just like. It's so innocent. Also, just like, look at these maps. If we push this cupboard, we'll be able to find this door. And that was like,
yes,
the first.
Yes. Very Nancy Drew. But again, that speaks to, there's nothing inherently immoral about limited access to feeling. You know, just because I have limited capacity for shame, remorse, guilt, these things, that doesn't mean I want to cause pain or harm. In this case, having those things allowed me to get my hands on a map I wasn't supposed to have. Was I going to kill someone with that map? No, I wanted to see if this thing existed.
God, you're making me realize how much I missed out on because I was afraid of getting in trouble.
Well, I think, listen, but those are good constructs. They're helpful. But I think like so many emotional constructs, they're helpful to a point. You know, there is a tipping point and it becomes where guilt becomes not only unhelpful, but unhealthy. And my husband, who was raised a very strict Catholic, I think for him, what he liked about me was, hey, this person doesn't make me feel bad for wanting to do these quote unquote bad things. We can do these things together and it's fun. And are we breaking rules? Yeah, like every rule, but it's okay.
So you have this summer romance and then you are apart for a number of years and then you come back together into each other's lives when you're in your 20s and you pick up right where you left off. Mm-hmm. And then as you're both sort of figuring out your career paths, there's this time you describe where he's working a lot. You're trying to figure out whether you want to go to psychology grad school. You're working in the music business that your dad works in. You're not sure it's the right fit. And this led to a breakup. And you broke up for a reason. Everybody breaks up in their 20s. It's like, I don't feel like you understand me in the way you once understood me. But for you, I just thought, oh my gosh, what a heartbreak for you because he was so singular. Mm-hmm. What did heartbreak feel like?
It felt, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, it felt a lot like when my ferret died, which is I had my buddy here and my buddy's not here anymore. And there is, you know, a moment where we have broken up and David's leaving and I know it's now or never, like, you know, cry, do it. For even if you have to force yourself, make yourself have a feeling about this. And I just couldn't, you know, I felt sad, but also I think it was the greatest thing to ever happen to our relationship because had we kept going the way that we had, I probably would have done something so destructive as a way to rebel that there would have been no coming back.
Mm-hmm. And when did you, was there like a time where you officially decided we're doing this and we're in this? How old were you when that happened?
I think maybe 30. But even after we got married, we separated again. So we had some We had some starts and stops even after we make the commitment to keep going.
I don't know if this resonates, but I wonder if that's also a function of not being controlled by, like, shame and societal expectations. There's a lot of relationships that could probably benefit from time apart, but what it looks like to separate can be such a hurdle.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right, because I remember at one point, there was a conversation about not living together. And I remember a lot of people saying, if you do this, that's it. Like, you don't take a step back in your relationship. Like, if he moves out, like, that's it. And I just remember thinking, says who? You know, like, this is what is necessary, whether our relationship continues as friends, whether our relationship continues romantically. I can't tell you what is going to happen if we separate, but I can tell you what's going to happen if we don't. And I'm not going to adhere to these, like, crazy rules, like, oh, once you live together, you can't unlive together. That doesn't make, like, well, everyone's gonna know. And I'm like, okay, you know, great. You want me to throw a party? I don't care.
Did you know you wanted to become a mother? Always?
I did. I really did. I remember thinking, I might not be a mother the way other mothers are, but I can speak to kids in a way that other parents or adults, they seem to lose that ability. And I remember saying that as a kid, and someone saying to me, oh, you think that now, but when you grow up, and I remember thinking, no, I'm always going to know. And I do.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
This clear-eyed, simple way of being able to speak, honest way.
Yes.
So when your child is hurt or is, you know, overcome with feeling, what is it? How do you experience? Do you come at it with, like, can I solve this problem for them? Mm-hmm. Or it's a logic response.
Right. It's my job is to observe their emotion, not take it on. Mm-hmm. So here's a perfect example. Our oldest comes home. He failed the test. His father is angry that he failed the test. I can't believe this. How can you do this? I have no anger. Mine is, how do you feel about this? You feel pretty crummy about it? Okay, let's talk about that. What do you think you're going to do to avoid feeling crummy in the future? So my emotion about my reaction has no part in this conversation at all. It's, talk to me about how you feel. Is this something you want to repeat? It's more problem solving.
Do you ever have a temper with them?
Very rarely. I do not have much of a temper at all. And my kids make jokes that if mommy starts to get mad, we've really blown it. Because it is so rare. And it has to be a series of egregious acts that are going to cause my voice to rise.
Huh. Can you draw the line for me from being a child who once stabbed another child with a pencil to being a mother that is so rarely sort of out of emotional control, that she rarely raises her voice? Like, does that seem,
I think I have a really clear answer from my end. My action of stabbing the child, it didn't come from rage or anger, or I'm so mad, I can't control my rage, therefore I'm going to hurt you. It came from the pressure's building. I'm going to do something crazy. And I've done something crazy. And now it's all gone and I can just relax. And once I learned how to manage that stress, those compulsive behaviors fell by the wayside.
Patrick's children are now 13 and 8, so there are more tough conversations coming for her as a parent about puberty and sex, aging grandparents, and all the ways that life can disappoint you. But Patrick doesn't see it that way.
Oh, man. I wish I could do something so that they didn't have to go through this. But also, going through things is the only way to arrive at the other side and grow from something.
Do you feel anticipatory grief?
I don't know. I don't know what that means. So probably not, but can you help me understand it?
I think kind of like, you know, say you become your someone you love is declining or very ill, and that feeling of like wanting to hold on and like, I don't know. It feels like a sense of like a mix of love and dread kind of mixed together is how I feel it.
No.
Uh-huh.
No, if anything, it's the opposite. I want, if someone is declining, I want it to be over sooner for them.
Oh, huh. Are you afraid of death?
I'm not. But I'm not, you know, skipping through the graveyard either. I mean, look, as my dad likes to say, of course I'm afraid of death. I've never done it before. And I've always sort of resonated with that because, look, I think it's easy to say I'm not afraid of death. If I was facing it, I'm certain that I would have a different reaction. But sitting here talking to you, it's something I've never done before. So I'm curious, but I don't think I've ever been scared.
That's Patrick Gagné. Her memoir is called Sociopath, and it's out now. This episode was produced by Zoe Ajoulay. Thanks to Dr. Liam Lynham, psychology professor at Purdue University, for answering some of our questions about antisocial personality disorders. Death, Sex, and Money is produced by Slate. Please support the production of our show by becoming a member of Slate Plus. You'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, but you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the great shows that Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. Be a part of helping us build a solid foundation for Death, Sex, and Money at Slate by subscribing to Slate Plus. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or you can go to slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. You'll be supporting the show and the people who make Death, Sex, and Money with me at Slate, Zoe Ajoulay and Andrew Dunn and Cameron Drews. Daisy Rosario is our senior supervising producer at Slate. Alicia Montgomery is Slate's head of audio. Our theme music is by the Reverend John Delure and Steve Lewis. And if you're new to the show, welcome. We're glad you're here. You can find us and follow us on Instagram at Death, Sex, Money. And you can get my weekly newsletter at annasale.substack.com. And our email is deathsexmoney@slate.com, where you can reach us anytime with voice memos, pep talks, questions, critiques. We love hearing from you. Patrick also told me that she can see how someone with her personality type could be drawn to politics for how it rewards charm and charisma. She did not, however, want to say how her sociopathy has affected her own politics.
The only reason I'm not more vocal about it is because with the misconceptions about sociopathy as they stand today, I don't believe myself, my public support would be helpful.
Uh-huh. I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from Slate.